First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
It's election day, and guess what? Hurricane season is almost over, but we're not out of the woods just yet. Good morning. We're live from Studio 2. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, the latest on early voting numbers, and also Nicole, that storm barreling towards the state. You can join us on the phones, 549-2937. Then later, many of you have already voted early as voters head to the polls in these historic midterms. We'll check in on how the balloting is going. Plus, tell you about the great Greenscape tree giveaway. That and more all ahead this hour. But first this morning, a powerful storm packing torrential rain and damaging winds is on track to slam Florida's East Coast Thursday as a Category 1 hurricane, with scattered showers due to start today, just as voters head to the polls. Subtropical Storm Nicole is expected to make landfall early Thursday morning above West Palm Beach. This, as many across Florida are still enduring the aftermath of Hurricane Ian and the devastation that storm caused on the state's west coast and inland, too. Megan Borowski is a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network and Florida Storms, and she's on the line now with the latest on Nicole. Hey, Megan, good morning.
Hey, Melissa. Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. You know, you usually think of November as not being a time when we get hit with storms, but no more. Warming oceans mean we have to really be vigilant all the way through Thanksgiving, right?
Yeah, and, you know, even beyond that, too. And this season has been quite the outlier. We were projecting an above-average season, but when those storms would occur, we're not able to forecast, but we're starting to see the season really start to ramp up, or we saw it over the past several weeks.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about Nicole. Tell us about this storm.
Right, so right now it's well east of the Bahamas. It's a subtropical storm, so that means that it's center has some cold air in it, and that also means that the wind field is a little bit asymmetric. So most of the winds actually extend northeastward out of the center of the storm. Now, because it is over warm ocean waters, you've got favorable upper-level winds, it actually looks like Nicole will transition into a full-blown tropical system and gain some more symmetry throughout the day today, and continue strengthening as it moves westward tomorrow into early Thursday. And we are expecting it to become a Category 1 hurricane just before landfall, and that landfall projected overnight tomorrow into early Thursday, likely along the Treasure Coast. Now, the track after that, it'll move to the northwest before being scooped up by another weather system over the Great Lakes, and that'll then take Nicole northeastward, really race it up the mid-Atlantic coast toward the northeast by the weekend. But here for the First Coast, we're expecting a multitude of hazards. Gusty winds have already begun, and they will continue to ramp up, especially tomorrow into Thursday. We'll see on and off downpours today, but that chance for the heaviest rain really picks up tomorrow into Thursday. And something else that we really need to consider is that winds are onshore, and they're gusty already. Storm surge inundation is forecasted to crest 3 to 5 feet along the Atlantic Ocean, and 2 to 4 feet along the St. John's River. And that's really what I'm most concerned about.
Yeah, if you might, Megan, share a little bit more about that, about the inland flooding risk here in North Florida, because we have learned that very painfully that can take us by surprise with these storms.
So there's a couple of factors at play here. So first of all, we've got winds from the east northeast, and so that is pushing water into the mouth of the St. John's River that prevents the river from draining into the Atlantic Ocean. So that's the first thing we need to consider. On top of that, as Nicole does start to wrap on shore, we get those bands of downpours moving on in. We're looking at the potential of anywhere of 3 to 5 inches of rainfall, anywhere from Wednesday to late on Thursday. Locally, 6 to 7 inches are possible. But when we get that rainfall and then we get that prevention of the drainage of the St. John's River, that just allows everything to back up, and that will give us a threat for inland flooding. So it's a substantial risk, especially along the I-95 corridor.
What else should people know as we prepare for this storm? You know, later in the hour, we're going to be checking in with FEMA as they open a disaster recovery center in Palatka. That's in our listening area. because, right. you know, people are still reeling from the impacts of Hurricane Ian in this state.
I know. The good news or the silver lining on all this is that Fort Myers will be spared the worst from Nicole. So that is the one positive. But, you know, for our area, do not take the category or the classification of this storm and think, oh, you know, it's not going to be as bad as Ian. Each storm is different. This has a very wide wind field, and we are looking at the potential for the First Coast of getting hurricane force gust winds at times, especially on Thursday during the morning and early afternoon. Tropical storm force gusts that anywhere from 45 to 55 miles an hour could continue throughout the day on Thursday. So as we get that rainfall and we get those strong winds, that could down trees, could down power lines. So be prepared for power outages.
Sure. And of course, our utility, JEA, they are going to be working overtime once again. Nicole, as I mentioned, hurricane season doesn't officially end till the end of November. You know, as we have watched these increasingly powerful and more frequent storms batter the state of Florida in recent years, what do you tell your listeners and viewers about the impact of warming oceans and how much of that is a factor in what we're experiencing here in the on the Florida Peninsula during storm season?
Well, certainly right now we do have the warm waters offshore, and that is one of the ingredients needed for a tropical cyclone to develop and to strengthen. So, you know, as we go further out in time and we do have those warmer waters in play, yeah, I mean, they could contribute to higher frequency of storms, but there's also other ingredients that we do need in play, and that's favorable upper-level winds and also low-pressure systems that are already in existence. So certainly the warmer waters will increase chances because they could help continue to support storm strength.
Now, Megan, tell us a little bit more about the importance of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network as we track these storms, and also this free app that you and your team have created called Florida Storms.
Yep. The Florida Storms app is available for all iOS and Android devices. Download it on your iPhone or your smartphone or your tablet, and we give up-to-date radar information. You can look at the radar map, also up-to-date forecast for your particular area. On there, you can also look at our social media feeds and any articles that we have published for any public media station throughout the state of Florida. And we'll be here in the Storm Center located in Gainesville 24/7 over the next couple of days, providing live radio, TV and digital content for the entire state, including the Jacksonville metro area, giving updates on what's happening now with Nicole and what the forecast is. So everybody can have that life-saving information they need as the storm barrels down on our area.
I want to thank you, Megan. Megan Borowski, meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network and Florida Storms. Thanks, Megan, so much.
Thank you, Melissa. Stay safe.
You too, and we will have updates all this week here on 89.9 FM on Nicole through our partners at the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. We also expect Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry to give the city an update later today on projected impacts from Nicole. We'll bring you that information as well as soon as we get it, but let's be prepared for this storm, folks. All right, it's 9:15, and we want to shift gears now. On a day that's making both weather and political news, we're going to take a few minutes here on the show today to discuss health. How can we become healthier? How can Florida become healthier? Last week, an important symposium was held in this area on the social determinants of health. What is that? Is that a new term for you? We have two experts in studio to explain why this matters. We're pleased to welcome Dr. Jeff Goldhagen, professor of pediatrics at the UF College of Medicine. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Dr. Mintu Bachan, I think I mispronounced that, the CEO of C3S, a Jacksonville AI health software company.
Thank you, Melissa.
Good to have you both. As we talk about health in this state and the social determinants of health, give us a call. It's 549-2937, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax. And you know, Dr. Goldhagen, before we get into this, can I just say right off the bat, being worried about hurricanes, political violence, climate change, COVID, None of that is making us any healthier. We are a population on edge.
And that's very much true. And you know, one of the issues which we'll talk about today is that our focus has always been primarily on medical care, when we know that 80% of health outcomes actually relate to social and behavioral indicators, determinants of health. So we spend $4 trillion, more than $4 trillion on health care, and only 3% of it goes to actually population health. And so we're spending 80% of our, or 80% of our funds actually on only the 20% of the outcomes.
Why do we do that?
Well, we've known for the past decade or more that our health really depends on social determinants of health. But we have a huge healthcare industry. We build hospitals. We build electronic medical records. We build, our system is focused on building and focusing strictly on the delivery of medical care, as opposed to addressing the upstream issues that really are grounded in social and environmental determinants of health.
If we did a better job with those, we would be in the hospital less, we'd have fewer diseases, we'd have healthier kids.
Absolutely. And the World Health Organization, although we have the best hospitals and the best physicians in the world, we're ranked last among high-income countries for our health system. We're 45th in the world as far as life expectancy and the health and well-being of our children, as defined by UNICEF, is the worst among high-income countries.
549-2937. So, Mintu, tell us about the symposium that was held in our area last week, looking at all of this.
Thank you, Melissa, for having us. First, there's been a line of demarcation between the social care agencies and healthcare agencies. What we have done with the symposium is to bring both agencies together, because what COVID-19 taught us is that you cannot have healthcare without social care. So social care is the de facto healthcare, really. But at some point, you have to recognize that we have to bring all together. Let's take an example, for instance, when a pregnant mother is going to go to social care first, that I need help more than healthcare first. So therefore, the social care became a path to healthcare. What is happening this for the last 133 years, that it hasn't been together, although we have been talking about it, but it has happened back in 133 years ago in Chicago by John Adams, but still we are talking about it.
Are you talking about Hull House?
Yes.
Yes, I know exactly all about Hull House, and that was taking care of a community approach to healthcare. Is that fair to say?
True, but at the same time, she had the initiative, she had the intention of bringing both the social care and healthcare together.
Okay.
Even though taken care of by the community, but at some point, at that time, we didn't have a healthcare system as a whole in this country, but we do now.
Yeah.
So therefore, it's time for integration of both services so we can holistically provide help to our patients.
Tell us about your company and what it does.
So C3S AI is a Jackson-based artificial intelligence-enabled population software company. Through C3S, social care and healthcare agencies can proactively work together to maximize their collective impact.
How do you use artificial intelligence to do that?
I'm glad you asked me that question. The AI is not as some kind of God-given something that, you know, is gonna, everything's going to take it for itself. AI is nothing more than a technology, or actually mathematical algorithm, that integrate things together, or a problem that AI can resolve that we haven't resolved before. So AI is really a tool rather than a solution by itself. So what we are using AI to determine, for instance, a person holistically, who you are, number one. Number two, the types of health issues you may have or social issues you may have. Number three, we determine kind of resources you may need. And then subsequently, we provide the resource allocation and what they are and how to get it, and help caseworker provide those resources to the recipient.
So, and I'm looking at your information here. You say even the best modern medicine can't help a person living in a food desert or a violent neighborhood.
Correct.
That's a lot of people in our listening area alone. So how can you realistically help them if that's their lived experience?
One of the issues, obviously the food desert and violent neighborhood beyond my pay grade to discuss here, but I think what we are saying is that we have to take one step at a time. So let's step back a little bit. Someone, a child in a food desert, and if a teacher finds out that child is mathematically brilliant at first grade or second grade, this technology will find resources for him or her to get those resources. Currently, that is not available. One of the most important features of this technology is that while we live in a certain area, a certain zip code, but resources may not be available in those zip codes, but technology will enable you to get resources from other zip codes that you needed in this particular zip code.
This is interesting stuff. Dr. Goldhagen, what are your thoughts about how this can work?
Well, this is a critically important transformation for healthcare. And what it does is it empowers consumers, individuals who previously did not have access to all the assets and resources in the community. So it empowers the consumer using a smartphone, actually, just even a smartphone, to identify what resources they need, where those resources are, and reach out to those organizations, those social care agencies, to actually receive those services. The other aspect of it is empowers physicians and healthcare providers, because at a moment's notice, we can identify what are the needs of a child or family, and actually make the referrals from our offices. We know that care coordination is critically important to health outcomes, and it essentially expands access to care coordination using technology and using artificial intelligence to do that. We spend literally hundreds of billions of dollars a year on electronic medical records, which are great, depending upon who you talk to.
Why are they great only depending on who you talk to?
Well, because they do add a tremendous amount of work to the physician's requirements. It was sold to be efficient, but actually takes a lot more work. But we're not here to talk about electronic medical records, but we are here to talk about the use of technology to advance health, and in this situation, to link providers and consumers to the resources they need, which 80% of those resources are social determinants and social care agencies.
So you're saying we would be able to download a free app and have a one-stop resource to try to connect ourselves to the kinds of support we need to better improve our health?
Correct.
And is that available now, or will it be available?
Well, that is, in fact, what C3S is developing or has developed. And currently there are no other resources that I'm aware of that provide that. Let me make one last comment about the symposium. To my knowledge, this is the first time that providers, payers, consumers, and social care agencies have sat around the table to begin to identify solutions to the critical issues that we are all facing.
Is that right? So tell us more about what that was like.
Well, 5 years ago, when we started C3S in Jacksonville, Florida, that was the intention, because I know, as Dr. Goldhagen mentioned, no one has done that, having a comprehensive platform that brings social care and healthcare together. In fact, there is no such thing as social care and healthcare together, because no one thought about it or no one did anything about it. So as Dr. Goldhagen mentioned, it was the first time. What we accomplished is that, number one, educating each other why we need each other. Going back to, again, when someone comes in for a certain healthcare issue, they go to social care first. Now we can refer this person to healthcare automatically.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing the transfer of information from social care to healthcare, and why the importance of combining the two, it became more educational platform, number one. Number two, it became, we discussed how we can do this together using technology.
And do you have an app ready yet?
Yes.
What's it going to be called?
It is C3S.
C3S.
C3S.ai. Yes, it's been now. Currently, we are from East Coast to West Coast, but we are deploying in different areas. But I think since we need to do more locally, and that's why we are here. I think that we live here, we work here. The invention was here, and I think we can work together, create a pilot program. That's one of the things we discussed during a symposium, that something that we can do together as payers, providers, social care providers, healthcare providers, and consumers, and we have this in Jacksonville.
And Jacksonville, I may be overstating this a little bit, but has become a mini tech hub in a way. There are some companies that have relocated here developing interesting technological products like yours. Let's go to some calls. 549-2937. Kate in the Rail Yard District. Hi, Kate.
Good morning. What you're talking about is really fantastic, and I'm excited for it to be coming. But my question is, we had simple contact tracing apps on our phones at the beginning of COVID. Why do we think this is going to work when we couldn't even get simple little apps to be used by people?
Oh, that's a great question. We couldn't even do contact tracing successfully with apps. So how is this going to be deployed in a way that will really make a difference? Thanks for that question, Kate.
Well, we couldn't use it, but all around the world in multiple other places, it was used to a great extent and very, very successfully. So that's a critical issue here in the U.S., that in fact we see ourselves as the core center of technology. When you travel outside the United States, in fact, there are many more technological advances that are being used on a routine basis than here in the U.S.
So it's not as though we don't have the technology. We might have a cultural problem.
Adoption is an issue, obviously, because something new is something different.
Mm-hmm.
But if I may step back a little bit, Jacksonville has a rich history of innovation. Most probably many people don't know that. And I can go back to during Barnett and Nation Bank days,
mm-hmm.
the reason Barnett was sold because of the technology, not what it's providing. I don't think a lot of people know that. It was because of two people's vision, Alex and Shirley. Similarly, what today is, C3I has been used during COVID and instead of Ohio, where they distributed from diapers to milk to other necessary goods for their patients. So it has been used. So I think we have an opportunity in Jacksonville to look at what other people have done and adapt those principles.
You want to extend this opportunity to companies, schools, even churches.
Yes.
Is that right? How will
yes.
that work?
Pretty much they will sign up with us, and then they can, then they have their users and they have their patients, and then subsequently find the resources and referral, they have a referral programs. You can refer to patients somewhere else or children, or most importantly, you can also control or enable someone who can connect with you as a part of your network.
Now, Jeff, your life's work is getting people to understand that the social and environmental determinants of health. I've heard you speak on this topic many times over the years. In particular, getting people to understand that if you don't get this right with kids in early childhood, they're really far behind the starting line for the rest of their lives. Can you talk about that?
Right. So we know in particular, as an example, that early brain development, the first 5 to 7 years are the most critical in a person's life. And so if we don't optimize, again, as an example, early brain development, then by the time the child is 7 years old or so, then we've lost the opportunity to optimize their, not only their brain development, cognitive development, but also their health later on, medical health later on. So for too long, we have kept the assets and resources limited, and it's been physicians and or other types of medical providers that have held the key to these resources. Now, this is all about empowering consumers. It's all about giving them the knowledge and access to all the resources that exist in a community that they themselves can reach out to. Not just medical resources, but educational resources, transportation resources, everything that exists in a community now becomes available on their smartphone to access.
Pretty amazing. And let me also make a quick mention of a somewhat related project that's trying to help make Jacksonville healthier, looking at these social determinants of health. We just got an email about this. It's the Blue Zones Project in Jacksonville. Thursday, November 10th, 6:30 p.m., they are having a meet and exchange event. They will also be introducing their new executive director, Nicole Hamm, to the community. And this is it's a different kind of model and a different kind of thing that they're doing. But the Blue Zones Project is also focused on improving the community's health, and it's in a different way, not in the way you're doing, Mintu. But it's encouraging because there are all of these efforts to try to get at these deeper issues, understand the social determinants of health, and improve them. So that's encouraging.
Absolutely. I think we have an opportunity to work together. We complement each other and then expand this platform, expand this opportunity to the community.
All right. How can people find out more?
C3S.ai.
C3S.ai. Mintu, thank you. Jeff, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And thanks for coming by on this day when there's so much happening, and we're very excited to share this with everyone. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
Much more still ahead, meanwhile. Later, we've got to look at who's already voted out there as we check on numbers this election day. And up next,
we've set up a one-stop shop so that disaster survivors can go apply for their FEMA assistance, or if they've already applied, they can go and get an update.
A new disaster recovery center opening in Palatka for people still dealing with the aftermath of Ian, just as Nicole bears down. That's next. We'll be right back.
Clay Today, proudly serving Clay County, Florida. The Clay Today, Clay County Leader, Oakleaf, and Keystone Heights Herald. Your community newspapers. More information at claytodayonline.com.
Ameris Bank. No matter where you are on your financial journey, Ameris Bank is by your side and committed to financial peace of mind. Whether you need help with business, personal, or mortgage banking, we're with you. Ameris Bank is an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Welcome back. Well, today and tonight, all eyes will be on a subtropical storm, Nicole, as it strengthens into a Category 1 hurricane and heads toward the east coast of the state. But of course, many Florida residents are still recovering from the devastation caused by Hurricane Ian. FEMA has opened a disaster recovery center in Palatka for disaster survivors. It will be closed temporarily while the storm blows through. But still, we got an update last week when I spoke with Kim Fuller, FEMA's Office of External Affairs. Here's that conversation. Hey, Kim, good to be with you. So tell us about the new disaster recovery center in Palatka that FEMA has opened up.
Well, we opened that up about a week ago on a Thursday, and that's out at the Palatka, the fairgrounds over there. And we've set up a one-stop shop so that disaster survivors can go apply for their FEMA assistance, or if they've already applied, they can go and get an update. And then there's also a bunch of services and resources from the state as well as the county government. So it's a one-stop shop.
What all will people be able to access? What are the greatest needs right now?
Well, right now, the greatest needs is really housing. Where can people stay? And some people are still staying in, you know, their houses that really need to be mucked out. Some people are staying with family and friends, and that only lasts for so long. So what we want people to do is apply for their FEMA assistance. In some cases, they'll get individual assistance and household program grants, which will allow them to have housing, apartments, or even hotels in some cases for up to 180 days, which is about 6 months. So we don't want them to, you know, exit themselves from the program by, you know, trying to decide for themselves if they think they're eligible. Just go to the DRC, or you can call in go in a number of other ways, four other options to apply, and you can go one of those routes to let somebody else decide if you're eligible for the assistance.
Now, in our listening area, it looks as though people in Putnam and St. John's counties are eligible to apply for individual assistance through FEMA. You're making that available in 26 Florida counties. About $1 billion in relief money coming into Florida. Is that right?
Well, that's right. And in fact, from the last count, we're at $1.7 billion. And that's in the form of FEMA grants, National Flood Insurance Program claims, as well as loans from the Small Business Administration. We also have disaster recovery centers in Flagler County and in St. John's County, like you said. And if people would like to go out to those locations, they can look it up online at disasterassistance.gov. Mm-hmm. We also have a very handy app you can put on your phone, and it will show you the closest disaster recovery center, or you can even apply on the app yourself for the FEMA assistance, or you can call an 800 number any day of the week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. And I know some people might have had a little bit of trouble getting through on the phone right when the disaster was over, but now it's a little bit easier to get on through the 800 number.
All right. And FEMA's National Flood Insurance Program has gotten tens of thousands of flood insurance claims and paid out hundreds of millions to policyholders. Can you share with us how big an issue flooding has been for Florida property owners and that piece of it?
Well, you know, people were concerned about the wind damage initially, but because so many of the rivers and lakes in at least eastern Florida ended up, you know, rising much quicker than they expected, there is a lot of flooding, and that's why they need the flooding assistance available for the east coast of Florida as well.
And anything else people should know about how they can access support after Ian?
The biggest thing is we ask people to stay in touch with us, because their situation might have changed, their housing component might have changed, they might have less people living in their house, more people living in their house, they're staying with someone. So any change in your situation, you should call and stay in touch with us. Or if you haven't heard from FEMA in a while, please give us a call. Sometimes we're just waiting for a little bit more information from you to be able to process your full application. We don't want anyone to sit there without the needed assistance when it's just, you know, something that we might be waiting on.
All right. Thank you, Kim. She's Kim Fuller, Office of External Affairs, on the line from Washington with FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Thank you so much for this update.
Thanks so much. And anytime you need us, you give us a call, okay?
Well, today, of course, is Election Day. People will be heading to the polls until 7 o'clock tonight, but it turns out a lot of you out there have already cast your ballot. Jacksonville Today's Claire Heddles has been looking at the early voting numbers and other voting news and notes from our area and around the state, and she's here now in studio. Hey, good morning.
Hi, Melissa. Nice to see you.
Good to see you. Okay, so how strong is the early voting out there so far?
So as of right now, 34% of Duval voters have cast a ballot. That's about 224,000. Mm-hmm. As of last night, early voters, mail voters, it was about 30% of registered Duval County voters, and Republicans had a slight lead of about 2,500 votes there.
It's my understanding that Republicans made up, they're really performing strongly already in the early voting. Is that right? Is that what you're seeing?
I think that was predicted in the polls, and we are seeing that a fair amount statewide. I think in Duval County, we looked at the past five midterm general elections to see how it compared, and we actually, the margin of difference between Republican and Democrat votes during early voting is closer this election than it was in 2006, 2010, or 2014. All three of those elections, Republicans led early voting. 2018 is the only midterm in the past 5 years with Democrats.
Don't know what happened there. Keep on going, though.
Okay. When Gillum was on the ballot and really mobilized Democratic voters, and that was also, of course, during former President Trump's tenure.
Yeah.
That's when we saw the most Democrats early voting, but we have seen Republicans lead early voting the past five midterm election cycles here.
Okay, and that's Duval County in particular.
In Duval County in particular.
Now, of course, we've got the governor's race on the ballot. We've got a Senate race on the ballot here in Jacksonville locally, a closely watched sheriff's race. Those are the big races we'll be watching tonight with our special live election coverage, both on the radio and some television updates. And, of course, we'll be updating our digital website at wjctnews.org throughout the evening. But, you know, you've been writing at Jax Today about other issues with balloting in Florida, particularly voter intimidation. What's happening?
So we looked into a program, this poll chaplain program, that a nationwide organization has implemented in 10 states, which they say have recently passed laws that could result in voter suppression. And one of those states was Florida. They looked at historic voter complaint data to pick precincts that they felt like the most voters had made complaints about intimidation, and are sending 25 poll chaplains across Jacksonville to be eyes and ears and what they say is kind of a voice of peace at these polling sites today.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to Northeast Florida supervisors of elections to find out, you know, how many voter intimidation complaints they've received. We saw one incident in Duval County where someone who claimed to be a poll watcher hit an employee the very first day of early voting. And in St. John's County, we heard from the supervisor of elections that she was seeing some people backing traffic during early voting.
Hmm.
But we haven't seen a lot of complaints of voter intimidation, but the state also doesn't proactively advertise those the way they do complaints of voter fraud. Though voter intimidation is also against Florida law. We have heard from some candidates. I talked to LaShonda Holloway, the CD4 candidate, and she was saying she heard from voters who felt nervous after the high-profile arrests that DeSantis advertised a few weeks ago, that she was hearing from legal voters who had felonies on their record, who had their voting rights restored, who were scared to vote because of these high-profile arrests.
Yeah, let's discuss that a little bit more. The governor's new Office of Election Crimes and Security controversially announced that deputies recently made 20 arrests around the state, 15 of them involving black voters accused of voting illegally. These were people with prior felony convictions. They were charged with casting ballots, even though the state said they did not qualify to vote. However, these were people who applied to register, got voting cards, and were told by their local supervisors of elections that they should go ahead and vote. They were never told they had done anything wrong until police showed up to arrest them. These arrests were captured on video, and when the video was released, it caused widespread outrage and, in fact, lawsuits as well. But isn't this kind of a chilling effect on voting for some people in the state? They're worried they might get arrested if they try to vote.
Right. That's what some candidates have told me. They've heard from their constituents, of people that they think might vote for them. And that's also what we've heard from voting rights groups, is that they're hearing concern from people that do have the right to vote, that have had their voting rights restored, that know that some of these high-profile arrests were also under the impression that they had their voting rights restored already when they were arrested. So I think there are candidates, particularly Democratic candidates, that are concerned that some of their voters won't be turning out. And that's part of what this poll chaplain program is. They're planning to be at the polls providing information, what voters should do if their name isn't on the voter rolls, how to cast a provisional ballot, things like this.
And maybe dial down the temperature a little bit.
Right. That's the other goal. We are seeing reports from Arizona. We haven't seen any in this area yet, but in Arizona, there were armed poll vigilantes standing outside ballot boxes. The Arizona Secretary of State has made a voter intimidation complaint form, has put out a strong statement against voter intimidation. We have not seen that from Cord Byrd, and his office did not provide us
the Florida Secretary of State.
The Florida Secretary of State. he hasn't openly spoken about voter intimidation, though it is also against the law, like voter fraud is.
Now, supporters of the new Florida voting laws and this new election crimes office say that we need these changes to guarantee secure and fair elections. But there is no evidence of widespread voter fraud in Florida. And in fact, the Florida Supervisors of Elections Association, a bipartisan group, has repeatedly pointed out that Florida's elections have never been more secure. So we need to point that out.
Right. I think we've seen the state really advertising these arrests that they've made, these few arrests. Some of them, as you mentioned earlier, have been overturned, but by and large, voter fraud is extremely rare. And I think supervisors of elections can attest to that.
Now, with all of that said, the polls are open and they will be till 7 o'clock, both at both of our websites, wjctnews.org and at jackstoday.org. We've got a wealth of information about races on the ballot, including judicial retention races and other races and matters to help you make an informed choice when you go to vote. Can you tell us about that?
We have voter guides at jackstoday.org/vote. We have it on the constitutional amendments, the judge's voter guide, soil and water districts, some of these smaller races that you might not know about. Mm-hmm. We have all of that information on jackstoday.org/vote. And I will say, as I was talking to voters last week at polling sites, people were also saying, as they hear about the arrests, it's increasing their determination to vote, that what they're hearing from their friends and family is stronger determination to show up to the polls. And I think in early voting turnout, we're not seeing the huge Republican lead that I think might have been predicted.
Hmm. Well, no matter who you vote for, it's important that you do vote. This isn't off your election, and it doesn't have the turnout of a presidential cycle. But you know what, Claire? This is a really intense midterm election, and there are a lot of people motivated to vote that might not otherwise vote in an off-year election. So tonight will be fascinating to see the results come in.
I think the high-profile sheriff's race, there's a ton of money that's gone into that race as well that might be mobilizing voters too, especially in Duval County.
Yeah. So folks, go to our website at wjctnews.org and follow us tonight on 89.9 FM and also live on television as we bring you the latest results. Also, deep dives into everything you need to know as a voter, a really good voter guide with lots of articles and information that Claire and others have developed at jackstoday.org. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Melissa.
Okay, when we come back, it's your chance to get a free tree without ever having to leave your car. We'll preview the greenscape of Jack's great tree giveaway and how you can get your hands on a beautiful specimen for your home or business. That's right after this. Keep listening. We'll be right back.
Announcing Vickers Landing at Oak Bridge, bridging retirees with an all-new Ponte Vedra Beach community featuring new homes, a resort lifestyle, and a life plan for every stage of aging. Information at vickerslanding.com.
Cindy Tomasetti, broker associate with Ingle & Volkers, during this season of gratitude, wishes to thank the buyers and sellers who trusted her with their real estate needs. Life's taking you places. We'll help you get there. Cindy Tomasetti, 954-980-1450.
midterm elections in the U.S., but there's a whole world of stories out there. Migrant workers who are shut out of Russia, the latest from the UN climate conference, and a remote Spanish village that was desperate to attract young families.
Las medidas contra la despoblación no nos sirven.
A local official tells us a story of how they got people to come. All that and more next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Jerry Lee Lewis, the rock and roll great who died last week in Memphis. We'll hear our interviews with his sister, pianist and singer Linda Gail Lewis, and with Myra Lewis Williams, who married Jerry Lee when she was just 13. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
When the results come in, we could see an election map that resembles two countries, one rural and red, the other urban and blue.
It's gotten tough living around here. And honestly, I just can't wait to get out, but I don't know where to go.
How do you live outside your preferred political bubble? Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, this is really fun. This is your chance to add a tree to your yard and increase Jacksonville's tree canopy at the same time. The 33rd annual Great Tree Giveaway is coming up. And yes, they're giving them away. You can get a free tree without ever leaving your car. With more on the giveaway, I spoke with Lisa Gruba, Executive Director of Greenscape of Jacksonville.
Hey, Lisa, it is so good to talk to you, and thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I'm excited to talk to you about the great annual tree giveaway. This is Greenscape's 33rd annual in the city. This is a much-loved event. Tell us all about it and what we can expect.
Well, you're right. This is the 33rd annual event. It's hard to believe that this goes back to the Ed Austin administration when Mayor Austin was in office. So we've been doing it a long time. We give away up to 2,000 trees a year. And the reason we do it is to get some trees into the hands of the public and get some trees on private property and increase our tree canopy here on the Northeast Coast. We have 8 species to choose from this year, and like last year, we'll be doing a drive-through event. That was something we started during the pandemic, but we liked it so much that we just continued it as a drive-through event. So we'll be at Lot E at TIAA Bank Field, just like last year. This will be Saturday from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., and it's first come, first serve. We're also partnering this year with Keep Jacksonville Beautiful, and they are doing a recycling event. So you can bring up to 2 30-pound bags of paper documents for recycling, and partner Republic Services will collect those documents and haul them off-site for shredding. So bring your documents or come for a tree or both, whichever you'd like to do. And again, that is Saturday, November the 12th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m.
You know, this is such an easy way to get a tree for your property. This is free. I mean, you can't get a better deal anywhere.
That's right. And I love the pictures that people have been sending me of trees that they bought 20 or 30 years ago that are in their yard now and are beautiful canopy trees. And we know that, you know, trees enhance property value in addition to giving us shade, taking up stormwater, because trees are basically pumps that pump water out of the ground. They provide carbon sequestration, habitat. I mean, there's so many benefits to having trees in your yard, and these are free. And so this year we have 8 different species. Do you want to hear what the species are?
Yes, please.
Okay. We have got Southern live oak, winged elm, river birch, Dahoon holly, bald cypress, crepe myrtle, red maple, and chaste tree. And all of these are on the recommended list from the Florida Urban Forestry Council for trees that do well in Northeast Florida. And these are these provide a variety of benefits. You have everything from a larger canopy tree like a live oak to a much smaller tree for a small space like a chase tree. Now, a chase tree was something that was newer to me this year. They grow up to about 15 feet tall, and they put beautiful purple blooms on in the spring. And so if you want to see a picture of the trees and learn a little about them, you can go to our website at greenscapeofjax.org, and you can see the tree menu. But also when you pull up that morning, we'll be handing out tree menus. And as you're kind of coming through the line, you can study the different characteristics and see which tree would work for you, your yard, in terms of sun and soil and water conditions and size. Because, you know, we always advocate right tree, right place. Mm-hmm. You want to match the tree to the conditions you have. And so check that out on our website.
Check it out, folks, and mark your calendar bright and early. Saturday, November 12th at Everbank Field. It's the 33rd annual Greenscape of Jacksonville Great Tree Giveaway. They're going to be giving away 2,000 trees. You can also hand off paper to be recycled. So Lisa Gruba, Executive Director at Greenscape, going to be a beautiful day for this. And thank you so much. Have fun.
Oh, thank you. We will. It is always a lot of community goodwill. It's always a lot of fun. We look forward to seeing everybody again.
And remember to feed your tree after you get it home. Thanks for listening. Thanks to David Luckin, Heather Schatz, Brendan Rivers, Brady Corum, Michelle Corum, and everyone who helps us get this show on every single day. Now, as I mentioned, it's Election Day, and the polls are open till 7 p.m. Get out and vote, everybody. We'll be back at 7 p.m. tonight with live results here on the radio, on television, and online. Thanks for the company, and make it a great day.
Teeth had been baby silver tooth. She grins and grins.